Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Okay. Thanks for coming along tonight. We put on the special function on Thursday night, which we don't often do, but it's great to see you all here to discuss matters relating to Tibet. Our speaker tonight is Dr. Lobsang Sangai, who's just come to Sydney from Canberra, where he had a number of important meetings in Canberra yesterday. Dr. Sangai was born in northeast India. He went to the refugee school there, and then he went to Delhi University. He spent 16 years at Harvard University, where he became a senior fellow studying law, and he obtained his PhD at Harvard. And in recent times, he's been the political leader of the Tibetan people. I should also say thanks to Kim Som and the folk of the Australian Tibet Council for advising of this function tonight. So welcome to Dr. Lobsang Sangai, speaking for us tonight on Tibet in the Asian Century. Thank you.
Thank you, Jared, for the kind introduction. He said he's going to make a short introduction. But do I have to describe my height and the color of my skin, all that? No? Great to be here. It's an honor and privilege to be here at the prestigious the Sydney Institute. And thanks to Jared and his staff members for organizing this talk on Thursday evening, which it seems they do it very rarely. And I'm supposed to speak on many issues. I'll start briefly with history, then why Tibet matters, perhaps from geopolitical point of view, then environmental point of view, then aspects of Tibetan democracy and nonviolence, and on in 30 minutes. And Jared will give me a hint, then I'll stop. So he's the boss here. Yes. So with that note, if you look at any map of China, you find that the actual China or the Han Chinese inhabited China is always 40% of the area. 60% continues to be, even today, inhabited by quote-unquote minorities like Tibetans, Uyghur, Mongolians, Manchus, and Yi and others, mainly in Yunnan province. So that's why Tibet is, you know, one-fourth of China, or maybe presently one-fifth. So Tibet is a huge tract of land. It's as big as Western Europe, or California and Texas combined, or whole of west of Australia. It's a huge tract of land, but population is only 6 million. Now historically, actually, you know, this whole debate about what China is, what China is going to be, is being a lot debated and written about. But as far as Tibetans are concerned, we have lived side by side by Chinese for many hundreds, even a couple of thousands of years. So we know them pretty well. Often they have invaded us, and at times we have also invaded them. And at one time, actually, Tibetan army moved all the way to the Chinese capital, Xi'an, and occupied the capital for a month, and expelled the emperor, and imposed our own. That's during the Tang Dynasty. In fact, during the Tang Dynasty, there was a treaty signed between Tibet and China, which stands in the form of a stone pillar even today in Lhasa, which says that Tibetans will be happy in the land of Tibet, Chinese will be happy in the land of China, signed by Chinese representative and Tibetan representative, thereby clearly establishing the fact that Tibet and China were two different states or nation states as early as 8th century. Since then, you know, there's been different emperors have come to China. But interestingly, if you read any Chinese historical textbooks, they always claim that Tibet became part of China during the Tang Dynasty because there was a marriage between Tibetan king and a Chinese princess. But actually what is not said is that the Tibetan king had an elder queen, was a princess from Nepal. And obviously he also had a couple of Tibetan wives. So, but the point being that the Chinese princess Wang Chen was the junior queen. Now, if you claim Tibet to be part of China, as with marriage relationship, then perhaps Nepal has first take on Tibet because the Nepali princess was the elder one. Then they thought, oh, this history is not working. And then they moved all the way to Yuan Dynasty when Mongols ruled China and said, since Yuan Dynasty, Tibet became part of China. If that is the case, then the question is raised. Chinese are not Mongolians. There's a Mongolia, which is a free and independent country, member of the United Nations. Mongolians are definitely the descendant of Genghis Khan. So perhaps Mongolians have more claim over Tibet than the Chinese. So now, nowadays historians are rewriting that also, and they have moved. Now what they're saying is during Qing Dynasty, definitely during Qing Dynasty, Tibet became part of China. So there's a lot of dispute, and I don't want to go into the details as back and forth. But at the end of Qing Dynasty, 1911-1912, Tibet became, according to some historians, de jure independent country, if not at least de facto independent country. So from 1911-12 to 1951, till Tibet was occupied or invaded and occupied by China, Tibet, by both accounts, de jure or de facto, was an independent country with our own tax system, with our own currency. Not even a single case of Tibet went to the Chinese judicial system. It was an independent country. In fact, when Nepal submitted its petition for UN membership in the 70s, they gave 7 reasons, I think, if I'm not wrong. The number one reason, if not number two, was that they had treaty relationship with Tibet. Nepal became a member of the United Nations, and Tibetans, unfortunately, our leaders were perhaps busy doing something else. They forgot to apply for the membership, or the history goes that they went all the way to Kalimpong in India. They played mahjong, they gambled around a bit, and they forgot to take their flight to New York or somewhere where they had to file a petition. But it's our own undoing that we were left out. So by the time the Chinese army marched to Tibet, they came in the name of peaceful liberation. So they will come and peacefully liberate Tibetans. And as per one version, Tibetans were backward, slave, dirty, filthy, and they ought to be civilized, because that goes with the concept of Dongguo, meaning the Middle Kingdom. China is the Middle Kingdom of the universe, of the whole world, not just Tibetans. And anyone who is in the periphery, like Tibetans, were barbarians, ought to be civilized and liberated. Unfortunately, anyone who were in the periphery, that includes Tibetans, as well as all the rest beyond that, that includes Australia also. So, from one historical account, all the people beyond Dongguo, the Middle Kingdom, were all barbarians. So we all are barbarians, brothers and sisters here in this room. I think at least most of us. So they thought they would peacefully liberate and civilize Tibetans. Unfortunately, that liberation was neither peaceful nor civilized, because as for one account, as high as 1 million Tibetans perished, died of starvation, killed. As for the Chinese account, actually, often it is said that during the Cultural Revolution, most of the monasteries and historical institutions in China and Tibet were destroyed, but not so. In Tibet, by 1963, as per the report submitted by Panchen Lama, which is submitted to Mao Zedong, which was later labeled as poison arrow, 98% of monasteries and nunneries were destroyed by 1963, 2 years before the Cultural Revolution. And a lot of deaths and destruction. So my parents fled to Tibet. My father was, in fact, a monk in a monastery called Lithang. His monastery was destroyed, bombarded and destroyed by 1956. And he fled to Lhasa and he joined a guerrilla force. Of all the things, he was made in charge of arms and ammunition. So can you imagine, one day you are a monk and a few months later you are a guerrilla in charge of all the arms and ammunition. But he thought he was defending his monastery, his faith and his country. Unfortunately, you know, Tibetans didn't have a standing army as such. At most they had 10,000 military personnel, so that might be less than police force of Sydney, maybe less. And then the Chinese troops marching, they were outmatched, outgunned. And unfortunately, His Holiness Dalai Lama and Tibetans, 80,000 of them, fled to India. And that's where I was born, in a refugee community, a small, very small village. I grew up going to the forest, cutting grass for two cows, at most three cows at a time, and a dozen or so chicken. And went to a refugee school where we ate dal and bhat, or lentil soup and rice, every day for dinner for 10 years. So that's how I grew up, actually, in refugee school. Now the question is, why Tibet was invaded? And there is this great game theory, as you might know. The Russians, the British, India, and China were interested in Afghanistan, Tibet, and Xinjiang. So they were dividing up the land among themselves. The British, India came all the way to Tibet in 1904, and the Young Husband Expedition. And along the way, they also killed many Tibetans. And then Russians were always interested in Soviet in Afghanistan. And what you see unfolding in Afghanistan is part of the same great game. Way back from the 19th, 20th century, even today. So even today, Tibet is geopolitically important in the sense the military buildup in Tibet is really huge. Already, according to some Indian media reports, five airfields, major airfields, are already there. They're building the sixth one. Railway line has come all the way from Beijing to Golmud in Qinghai, to Lhasa. Now they are expanding it to Shigatse, onto border of Tibet, in border of India to Sikkim, and one to Nepal. Then you can also cover the Bangladesh side. And if you go all the way to Sikkim, then you can cover the other side as well. And the highways now, according to some reports, it's being built all the way to India, all the way to the Indian border areas. And as we all know, China has built a major seaport in Pakistan, and they're building a big one, major one, in Sri Lanka. And there was an attempt, at least, in Burma as well. But then the President Thensin and the Burmese military leaders had a different idea. So then they release Aung San Suu Kyi, and they are attracting foreign, what they call democratic friendly investment from abroad now. Otherwise, India would have been surrounded by sea, by air, and by highways as well. So, and then I'm sure there are so many military experts here, you know the geopolitical significance. And then the military buildup in Tibet is very, very high, because then you can really oversee, reach out to South Asia as well as Central Asia, because Tibet has one of the longest border, all the way from near Kashmir all the way to Bangladesh. And environmentally also, Tibet is very important, because Tibet is also called third pole by some environmentalists, because after Antarctica and Arctic, Tibet has the third largest reserve of ice. And unlike Antarctica and Arctic, when ice melts, it goes to the ocean, but Tibetan ice, actually, when it melts, it provides water, fresh water, to 10 major rivers of Asia. Indus River, Tibet to India, to Pakistan. There's a bit of dispute. and then Brahmaputra from Tibet to India to Bangladesh, Salween and Mekong from Tibet all the way to Thailand, Laos, Cambodia and Vietnam. And Yangtze River and Yellow River all starts from Tibet. So now actually, you know, water is also called, in the Australian context also, it's called white gold nowadays. Because some experts say that wars were fought over land before, and wars are fought over energy nowadays, and wars will be fought over water in years to come. And Tibet has plenty of water, at least the origins of most of the major rivers in Asia. In that sense, Tibet is environmentally very important. And also, according to some environmentalist scientists, that the jet stream over Tibet affects the climate all the way to Peru, and perhaps to Australia as well. And the minerals, Australia is known for iron ore and coal, but Tibet also has a lot of minerals. According to some Chinese documents, 92 or 3 types of minerals, including uranium. I think the second largest copper mine in Asia, I think it's in Tibet. Definitely the largest one in China is an area called Zomda, and gold and borax, all kinds of minerals. So environmentally very important. Now coming to exile, I'll briefly go through the investment the exiled Tibetans have made in democracy and nonviolence in the last many decades, and why Tibet issue is important for the rest of the world. We have invested in democracy and nonviolence as per the vision of His Holiness Dalai Lama, and we have established a Tibet administration. And if Tibet issue is ignored or not supported, of course, because Tibetan cause is our cause, we will keep on with our cause. But it does send a signal to other marginalized groups around the world that perhaps is not worth investing in democracy and nonviolence. And then, when other marginalized groups resort to some nonviolent moves or violence, then tanks roll and helicopters fly to put out the flame. By then, it's a little too late. So, why it's important for the international community to support Tibet? Because we have invested and believed in and continue to believe in democracy and nonviolence. Now, if I lighten the mood and briefly take you to the world of Tibetan democracy, perhaps it might be of some interest, because I just went through a campaign of sort, actually. We never had a campaign style as such. I was criticized and perhaps supported for introducing modern election campaign, which means I introduced a website, I introduced a DVD, and I introduced a pamphlet and few posters, you know. Now, Tibetan election is unlike other democracy. It's not fought over within district or even a province or even within a nation, but it's cross-continent because Tibetans are scattered in 44 countries. So you have to have cross-continent election campaign. You literally have to run all over, and I had to do actually 1 week time, if I'm not mistaken. I had to fly from Delhi to Zurich to Boston to DC to Toronto and back. Because Tibet is scattered all over. I couldn't come to Australia at that time. It was, you know, it was taking too much time for me to come and go back to India. And I had my website, and through which I think some of the Tibetans in Sydney liked the website, perhaps photographed, but in real life they might not like me, but they voted for me anyways. And the seriousness of Tibetan democracy is, for example, Tibetans in Ladakh, near the border of Tibet. On March 20th, it was minus 40 degrees cold. Still, the Tibetan election commissioner, local election commissioner, they took ballot boxes on the backs of yaks and donkeys, climbed up the mountains for days, and waited, and the nomads came down from the tents and voted. And they collected the ballots and counted. And Tibetans in Bandra settlement is known for heat. It was perhaps around 40 degrees Celsius. Still, they came out without AC. They were voting outside, you know, and they stood for hours and voted. So from Alaska to Australia, Tibetans, everybody voted on, not everybody, all those who voted on single day. That shows our 50 years of commitment and our investment in a democracy. And the election was had a bit of a Buddhist element. And for example, me and the other candidate, the runners-up, Denzin Dedongla and Deshe Wongdila, we were the three candidates finally. Okay, if I detour a bit. Some websites started nominating me, and some organizations started also nominating me, actually by default. But nonetheless, they started nominating me. I thought I should give a run, you know. I called my friend, a very good friend. I said, hey, so many websites are nominating me. Perhaps I should give a run. Maybe I have a shot. And he said, well, what you really need is a graceful exit strategy. And I said, why? I said, look at the other candidates. Right? Former Kalun Tripa, Speaker of the Parliament, Deputy Speaker of the Parliament, most seasoned diplomat, and Private Secretary of His Holiness Dalai Lama. And who are you? Just because you spent 16 years at Harvard, you want to parachute down to Dharamsala and we will just, you know, vote for you? I said, anyway, I'll call my other friend. And I called my other friend and he said, give me 2 days. He called me back after 2 days and he said, I talked to all my friends in Dharamsala. That's where our administration is based. And in Washington, D.C., none of them are voting for you. So you get the clue. Hey, you are my friend. Yes, all your friends are not voting for me. That's an encouragement. Then I complained to my third friend. Hey, two of my friends saying like this. What do you think? He thought for a while. He said, Lofsang, you have nothing to lose, so go for it. So with that encouragement, I went about campaigning. And there was a bit of a Buddhist element in the sense, in the final round, there were three candidates. And two of us were debating in Dharamsala. The next day we had a debate in Delhi. So we looked at each other and said, hey, let's take a taxi together. And we took 12 hours taxi ride from Dharamsala to Delhi together whole night with my other candidate. And then by the time we reached Delhi, the two of the organizers were knocking around. The hotel rooms were closed because it's 2 a.m. in the morning. Finally, they found one hotel which opened the door and said, how many rooms do you want? Well, we want 4 people, 4 rooms. No, we have only 2 rooms. Okay. Organizers shared one room. Me and the other candidates shared the other room. So we had good, sumptuous breakfast. Following that, we had good, hearty debate. Then we had good lunch together. And we bid each other goodbye and gave each other camping tips. Hey, by the way, that route that I took me 17 hours by taxi. So you can take the shortcut, you can make it 12 hours. And I'll talk to that guy and help you organize your camping trip as well. So it was kind of a Buddhist Herod might, Jared might not necessarily like it. He isn't like this lovey-lovey kind of a Buddhist. But sad to say, but our election was also a bit of a lovey-lovey kind of a thing. But at least we didn't show it, yes. So there was a Buddhist bit of element. And finally, on March 10th, that was now March 20th was the final round, and March 10th is normally the day when His Holiness Dalai Lama makes the most important speech of the year. So we all were looking forward to it, and I was sitting at the back end of the podium. So all along, all our candidates thought His Holiness is our spiritual leader and political leader. We all are coming to serve him and serve Tibetan people. But His Holiness has a different idea. On 10th March, he looked at the people and say, from today on, I'm giving up all my political authority to whoever gets elected. I nearly lost my balance. I said, oh, I thought he wants to be his political successor. Now, can you imagine His Holiness Dalai Lama, Nobel laureate, Templeton Prize winner, global statesman? Now, you have to fill in his shoes, the biggest shoes ever. And then I thought, oh, my goodness, you know, what am I supposed to do? That's a tough job to follow. Who am I? No one. As it is, all my friends were thinking I was no one because none of them were voting for me anyways. So I thought to myself, perhaps in normal democracy, you can give family reasons to withdraw. Hey, my wife became sick, so can I withdraw from this contest? But then it was too late because I was I got overwhelming majority in the preliminary round. So 10 days before the vote, and to take this responsibility to be his political successor and to take the challenge of the Tibetan people and facing country up north, China, you know, and the leaders. So I took a deep breath and said, you know what, if I start thinking, then you lead to paralysis banalysis. There's the historical context, political responsibility, the challenges. And I stopped thinking and I said, you know, this is my destiny. This is my karma. Tibetans ought to take the responsibility and move forward, lead the cause, and we have fulfilled the legacy of the elder generation, honor the sacrifices of the elder generation, and build on the hard work of the elder generation, and fulfill the expectation of His Holiness Dalai Lama and Tibetans inside Tibet. With that pledge, I step forward, and on March 20th, Tibetans all over the world voted. On April 27th, the result was declared. I was the winner. Now, the least experienced, youngest, never worked in Dharamsala, all that. 16 years in America, central heating. You know. Yeah. Going to Dharamsala, where it's, you know, literally in winter, it's warmer outside the house than inside the house in Dharamsala. So I welcome you all to come to Dharamsala, but not in winter. If you come, you are most welcome. Most likely you will not come because January, February is the best time here, so it will be pretty cold. I thought, yeah, I can substitute, you know, my white chocolate mocha from Starbucks with chai, Indian chai, you know. It's cheap also. And my salary, with, you know, instead of dollars, rupees is good. I mean, especially with the devaluation, I think I'm not so sure. So I'm the highest paid executive in this whole world, actually, head of the executive. I just get $360 a month. So, but I'm a Tibetan. Tibet is my homeland. Tibetan cause is our cause. And we have to provide leadership. And no matter how difficult it is our cause. And we have invested in democracy. And we have invested in nonviolence. So nonviolently, like great leaders of, you know, like Nelson Mandela, Martin Luther King, and Mahatma Gandhi, who set examples. There have been, I think, 50 non-violent cases, communities or nation states who have prevailed. And we want to be one of the successful stories of the 21st century. So non-violently and democratically, we'll march on, we'll march forward, and want to make Tibet the best story of the 21st century. And with your support, with your interest, with your engagement, we will get there, we'll climb the Himalayan mountains, and we'll reach the mountain top and look forward and see freedom on the Tibetan side. That will be the day when we all will go back, we Tibetans will go back, and that will be the day Tibetans in Tibet are waiting for. That is the expectations of Tibetan inside Tibet to see His Holiness Dalai Lama. That is why you might have read 42 Tibetans have committed self-immolations, of which 35 have died. So it reflects how desperate the situation is, how tragic the situation is. Given a choice, we all are human beings, we want to live than die. Even if you pinch someone, they will stare at you or slap back. But Tibetans are saying, the precious life that I have, I'll give up, because the situation is unbearable. And it should be taken note by the government in Beijing and by people around the world, because His Holiness Dalai Lama's view and Tibetan administration view is that we want to seek genuine autonomy within China, within the framework of the Chinese constitution. We are not challenging China's sovereignty or territorial integrity. What we are saying is, if the Chinese government implements its own laws, it could amount to genuine autonomy for us. So it is a reasonable demand, it is a moderate demand, but unfortunately the Chinese government refuses to solve the issue of Tibet even today. Instead, they clamp down, crack down, and oppress Tibetan people. That is why the Chinese government has recently announced they are going to shut down Lhasa, the capital city, as well as Tibet Autonomous Region for any foreign tourists. Discourage Chinese tourists, and even throw out Tibetans who have come from other places to Lhasa. So that is the situation, and the military presence is very high. If you go to Lhasa, They are sharpshooters on rooftops. They are military personnel in uniform marching up and down, in civil clothes as well. So Tibetans are feeling real suffocation. But we do believe our day will come, but we will fight our cause democratically and non-violently. And our day will surely come. Till then, remain with us, remain engaged with us, and what we are cherishing, or what we are aspiring, our values enshrined in Australian constitutions and Australian values, human rights, freedom, democracy. Thank you.
Many thanks to Dr. Lobsang Sangai, and for being precisely very impressed. You're right on 30 minutes. So Buddhists may be a bit lovey-lovey, but they keep good time. They do good time. Yeah, so that's great. We've got till 7 o'clock. I know there's a lot of interest in the room and a lot of people here, so we've got plenty of time. You mentioned Mahatma Gandhi, and as you well know from your law studies and from your reading, he was into non-violence, but of course he was dealing with the British government, and the British government, however tough Churchill and the others were, there was a rule of law in Britain, there were legal courts, there was an independent police system, it was a democracy. In your very brave endeavours, you're dealing with a Communist Party regime in Beijing that doesn't really recognise the rule of law. So how do you proceed with these current tactics if the Chinese don't really care about the number of people who commit suicide or democratic rights? They don't care in their own country, so why should they care with relation to Tibet? Maybe let's talk to the back of the room. And,
Actually, normally Buddhists are not just lovey-lovey, but the Buddhist concept of impermanence means it's the timelessness. You normally don't bother. But given your strict rule, I was timely today. Why should the Chinese government solve the issue of Tibet? I think Chinese government also has a lot to gain. I did give you a bit of historical context, because Chinese government can choose any historical era, Tang Dynasty or Qing Dynasty or Yuan Dynasty or Ming or Song. And we have had relationship for 1,000+ years, at least written history, and before that as well. So they could have picked any relationship, and that was acceptable to Tibetans. But what is happening is an aberration or a distortion of our historical relationship. And number two, Tibetans are not going to go away. Our parents' generation fought, lost, but then movement has continued even today, 50 years, still continuing. And about the self-immolations, 42 Tibetans have committed. Now, almost all of them, except one or two, were all below the age of 50, which means they all grew up under Chinese system, Chinese education system, economic system, political system. If they were to be brainwashed, or if they wanted to buy into the Chinese model, they could have bought. If they have benefited economically, they are the primary beneficiary. Even they are saying, 50 years hence, we have not benefited. We don't want the system. We don't want this present arrangement. In 2008, there was a massive protest all over Tibet. More crackdown. More military were sent. Now in 2012, more self-immolation. And it's happening in Xinjiang as well as in Inner Mongolia as well. Meaning, Tibetans were not suppressed for the last 50 years, and they will not be suppressed. During the Cultural Revolution, remnants of those destroyed buildings, destroyed monasteries were also torn down. And fighting against the four olds, Tibetan tradition, Tibetan language, essentially the Tibetans were all made to wear Mao suit and speak in Chinese and get rid of any tradition. But then 80s, what came back? Tibetan culture, Tibetan identity. So Tibetan identity, Tibetan solidarity, Tibetan spirit has never been stronger before. So which means it is continuing to stay. Now what does it that mean? Chinese government claims that it wants or it introduces harmony as a domestic policy and peaceful rise as its foreign policy. But then everybody will point out and say, where is the harmony? Look at Tibetans. You want to have rise peacefully, how you treat Tibetans doesn't look like you are going to rise peacefully. If you can do that, Tibetans should act Tibetans because they are supposedly Chinese citizens, then you are capable of doing the same thing to others as well. So a lot of questions will be raised for the Chinese government, and they want to rise peacefully. If they want to gain respect from the international community, first they ought to show respect in Tibet. Unless they do that, people might buy Chinese goods, people might fear you, but respect you have to earn. Only way you can earn is by respecting Tibetan people. In that sense, I think Tibet will be the issue that will be the dent or that will be the dot in China's image. Till they remove it, we will make sure Tibet issue is raised. Till I die, for sure, and others will do the same. And in that sense, China has a lot to gain as well. And what we are seeking is also reasonable, genuine autonomy within China. And which means China's sovereignty and territorial integrity is not threatened. Now, it also raises a bigger question here. Chinese government and Chinese leaders have accepted and granted one country, two system to Hong Kong. And Article 31 of Chinese Constitution allows that. Now, when we say, why can't, some Chinese also say, why can't Tibetans have one country, two system like Hong Kong? They will say, well, Hong Kong already had a British commercial system and rule of law. Hence, they recognize the status quo. They will not grant it anything special. If that is the case, then what about Macau? Macau was a crime-infested island. All the criminals from China fled to Macau. There was no law. In fact, it was a lawless island. And there was no commercial system except for underground, commercial system. Macau was also granted similar one-country, two-system, basic law. Now, Chinese government is willing to recognize the status quo of Taiwan or grant autonomy to Taiwan. Now, it begs the question, why Chinese government has granted autonomy to Hong Kong and to Macau and willing to give to Taiwan but not to Tibetans? Is it that Chinese government see Tibetans as you're not Chinese? They see Hong Kong, people of Hong Kong as Chinese and Macau as Chinese. Some might disagree, they consider them as Cantonese. Or people in Taiwan as Chinese. Many people in Taiwan say they are Taiwanese. They're willing to grant autonomy, and they granted autonomy to Chinese, but not to Tibetans. Which means, is this a racial issue? If you're Chinese, you go to Shenzhen, you go to Guangdong, more autonomy, more freedom. You come to Tibet, more police, more army, more guns, more bloodshed. So is this a racial issue? So the rise of China is a reality. For how long, we don't know, but presently it's a reality. But what kind of reality? A racial reality? Or economic rise? Or a peaceful rise? These are big questions, and Tibet is the answer in the sense, if Tibetans are treated fairly, world will applaud China. Tibetans not treated fairly, then that will indict the Chinese leadership. In that sense, China has a lot to gain by solving the issue of Tibet peacefully.
Just stay here, we'll have more questions. Yes?
In taking over Tibet, China has, I suppose, colonized Tibet by moving Chinese into Tibet. To what extent have Chinese moved into Tibet and intermarried with the Tibetans to try and water down that Tibetan identity?
The Chinese migrants have moved in. There are a couple of figures. One scary figure is that 7.5 million Chinese to 6 million Tibetans now I say it's a scary figure in the sense that includes traditional Tibet, all the border areas. All the border areas had for hundreds of years many Chinese. For example, His Holiness Dalai Lama's birthday had 90%+ Chinese, historically. Now, but inner Tibet still is Tibetan majority and continues to be. But in urban areas, Chinese migrants are moving in and dominating businesses. For example, 70%, 50%, 40%. 70% of shops and hotels and restaurants, business enterprises in Lhasa are owned or run by Chinese. 50% of Communist Party members, from postmen to the top, the judge and the executive, are Chinese. 40% of Tibetan high school and college graduates are unemployed. So that much of discrimination. And then Tibetan seeds say why? Who are benefiting the Han Chinese migrants? Fortunately, because of Tibet's plateau, it's quite cold in winter. In winter, 60-70% of Chinese migrants return, go back to their own homeland. So in peach winter, Tibet is Tibetan majority. So we are not that keen to have, you know, global warming that fast. So, and then intermarriages, very few, very limited. But if you are, if there are intermarriages, then chances that you might get promotion and the top rank in the Chinese leadership is very high. For example, this is now 4 or 5 years ago figure, I can check, I think it's essentially the same. Of the top 13 leaders in Tibet Autonomous Region, Lhasa, 13, 7, I think, were Chinese. And other 6, very interesting, other 6 are labeled normally Tibetans. If you look carefully, the first one actually is half Chinese, and their parents were Chinese. Second one is married to Chinese, 2 of them. And third one is perhaps whose brother-in-law is married to Chinese, something like that. So even the loyalty of, you know, the top leadership, even if they are quote-unquote Tibetans, and again it's linked to whether they're married to or whether they are children of. But then what it does is Tibetans, even the Communist Party leader, members, they look it up and say, hey, unless you have some Chinese blood or related to Chinese, you're not going to get there. And that, in 2008, became very clear. Massive protests in 100 different counties of Tibet, Tibetan areas, protests happened in 2008. Now, what happened was, it started in Lhasa. 1,000+ shops were vandalized and burned by Tibetans. And a few Chinese were also killed, but many more Tibetans were killed. Anywhere from 106 to 213 were reported. They are reported death of Tibetans. Now, what did the Chinese government do? Was they showed this vandalization and violence on CCTV, on national TV, day in and day out for several days, labeling Tibetans as thugs, criminals, ungrateful. But then what they forgot was, the same TV was watched by all those Tibetan elite or Tibetan Communist Party members. Then they started thinking, you know what, I've given my 20 years, 30 years of service to the Communist Party of China. I thought I'd get some reward, but this is how they define us, like criminals and thugs. When the mid-level or the little higher mid-level Tibetan Communist Party members started going to Chengdu or Xining for winter vacation, normally they go with their family members from Tibet. They were told that they cannot stay in the same hotel that they used to live for 5, 10, 20 years. They were told to live in a hotel cordoned off, meant for Tibetans. One example was CCTV invited 4 Tibetan scholars from Lhasa to defend the Chinese government version against the what they call Dalai clique or exile splittists, which is us, version. When these 4 scholars landed in Beijing, went to check in the hotel, they were told they cannot stay in the hotel because they had Tibetan identity card. They had to go and stay in the hotel cordoned off for Tibetans. Now, how would you feel? You are called to defend the motherland against splitters. And if you're told you can't stay in the hotel, but go somewhere else. So that is why it's not surprising that after 2008, what happened was before, till then, if you work in the same office, Tibetans and Chinese staff members, normally they all go out for dinner and attend each other's birthday parties, things like that. After 2008, Tibetans go their way, Chinese go their way. The fundamental idea of your identity was tested in 2008. So far less intermarriages, even intermingling, is being now gotten less and less.
Tom, right up the back. Just stay where you are.
One of the pillars of democracy is freedom of speech, despite the internet and some of the modern technologies. What strategies have you and your colleagues thought about in terms of overcoming the problem of having free speech in the environment that you have?
And that's a very good point, actually. You know, why self-immolation is happening in Tibet? Because there is no freedom of speech in Tibet. You can't have protests, you can't have rallies, you can't have demonstration. Even a student, if you march, even if you paste a poster, you get arrested, you know, often tortured, and you disappear sometimes. So that's why I think Tibetans are resorting to self-immolation, because they're saying, what are the chances if I go paste a poster, getting killed, or, you know, self-immolate? So that's, and even though we have discouraged drastic actions, including self-immolations, and made repeated calls, still Tibetans continue to do so. Now, how do we overcome what they call firewall? In one sense, pretty simple. China built a great wall, but still the Mongolian invaders, the barbarian invaders, continue to invade China. Now they are building firewall, but there is still a penetration is continuing. Through social network, Twitter. Yesterday only I was speaking in Canberra to a group of Tibetans. And where is Mr. Tharchin? He's not here. He just had the cell phone, and through the one software where Tibetans from all over the world log in. And he just taped my audio as I was speaking live, and it was broadcast live in Tibet. And after the talk, he showed me and said, look, how many thank yous and how many cries and how many folded hands were there, the lovely, lovely folded hands were there, thanking for the talk. And I didn't know that he was doing it. Had I known, I would have cracked less jokes and be more serious. Because I'm sure Tibetans in Tibet want to see a tough, macho guy, not lovey-lovey, you know, leader. But nonetheless, it was broadcast live. And then Radio Free Asia and Voice America, we are radios in the U.S., they are widely listened to and watched. And I also get some Facebook messages. This is a one-time account, don't respond, but I want to say thank you. And in fact, Tibetan artists, it's available on YouTube. Some of the popular Tibetan artists compose songs. They always compose songs in honor of His Holiness Dalai Lama. Recently, they have composed song in my honor. One song called Three Lions. My second name is Lion. I'm a kind-hearted lion. So they have composed, and he got arrested. It's another guy. The song goes like, we offer golden throne to His Holiness, and we will seek His teaching, and we offer silver throne to Lobsang Sangye, and He will lead us. And there's another song also about patriotism and trying to encourage me. Tanka paintings or paintings and pictures of me shared. All this are happening because this is cell phone century. Mm-hmm. Tibetans talk to each other. And I was told from Australia you can call Tibet for free nowadays for $90-some, some telephone company. Oh, this will be a podcast and Chinese embassy will know about it now. Mm-hmm. They're not vanity. But so on a daily basis, thousands of Tibetans, talk to each other. So yes, there was great wall. It didn't work. There is firewall. It will not work as well. So a lot of channels, I think, we are reaching out to Tibetans inside Tibet, but still it's difficult. Nonetheless, it's called struggle. That's why it's called struggle. Keep struggling. Keep moving forward.
So there's a question here.
Yeah. You mentioned this border, moves China's making around these different borders. What would be the aim of those borders? I mean, you take down Sri Lanka and down the Vietnamese coast border. But where are they? What is the point of fortifying themselves?
Well, I think it's pretty simple. China wants to be the superpower in the world. They want to expand. Indian Ocean, Atlantic Ocean, Pacific Ocean, all the way to Australia. And the world, So it's geopolitical expansion. So that is how the Indian news media and other news media are interpreting it. The border I was talking, actually was the border between Tibet and India. In fact, in 1914, there was a treaty signed between British India and Tibet called Simla Agreement. And now the border between India and Tibet was, because the British representative was Sir McMahon, so the border between India and Tibet is called McMahon Line. Even today, India recognized that as the border line. So it stretches all the way from Kashmir to Bangladesh. So it's a huge, some say it's the longest border. Some say Russia and China is the longest border, but some say that's, anyway, it's one of the longest borders in the whole world.
There's a question here. Yeah.
Is it true that during the Great Dane period, that Britain did grant China sovereignty over Tibet in return for certain trading rights?
There's a couple of treaties, actually. Simla Agreement was signed between British India and Tibet, which recognized the trade mission of British all the way to Shigatse, also to Lhasa. They said that's all they wanted. Soon after that, they signed another treaty with China. Interestingly, British recognized China's sovereignty over Tibet, but Tibet has suzerainty. That's a new word coined at that time, which means Tibet was de facto independent. Everything domestic they can handle, and except for treaty relationship with other countries. So the suzerainty remained a British policy for a long time, until recently actually. The British Foreign Ministry changed the word recently. So, and then there was a treaty between Russia and China and Britain, again recognizing sovereignty, but then having Tibet has suzerainty. So that's how it was played out during those days. But then one treaty recognized Tibet has the capacity to enter into treaty, which means if you go by the definition of state, as per international law, you have to have territory, government, population, and capacity to enter into treaty. Then you are a state. And we entered into treaty with British. We also entered into treaty with Mongolia. Nepal cited our treaty relationship with Nepal as an evidence to enter into a UN membership.
There's a question there.
Just interested in how you view the Australian government's position on
Tibet. Australian government view on Tibet, I think it has varied quite a few times. For example, when he saw in Israel, I visited before, John Howard, Prime Minister John Howard, met him twice. Since then, unfortunately, Olin Zalam has come to Australia, but has not been met by at least the ruling party, ruling leader. But the opposition, whoever was in opposition at one time, they ought to meet. And even this time, my trip became a bit of an issue in news media as to whether I will be able to meet Foreign Minister Honorable Bob Kaur or not. Whether we made a request to Julie Gillard, we did not. Bob Kaur and some organization made the request, but he refused. So whether meeting me or Dalai Lama amounts to something or not, since there's a bit of a zero-sum kind of a mindset. If you meet Dalai Lama, you lose business, China will cut us off. But actually, on the contrary, we all know President Barack Obama met with Dalai Lama twice. Recently, Prime Minister and David Cameron and Deputy Prime Minister Nick Clegg met with His Holiness in May. Aung San Suu Kyi met him. Prince Charles met him. Stephen Harper of Canada met him. The Chancellor and Foreign Minister of Austria met him. And then I think the President and Prime Minister of Poland, if I'm not mistaken, met him. The Foreign Minister of Czech Republic met him. Slovenia, Latvia, you can go from a very small country to big countries. Met His Holiness Dalai Lama, and their relationship with China is going on. Hence the zero-sum mentality that if Australian leader meet with Dalai Lama, then somehow we'll lose our business interest, I think, is overstated. Chinese Confucius are pragmatists. They buy iron ore and coal from Australia because Australia is cheaper. If Indonesia gives a cheaper rate, in a heartbeat they'll move there. You don't get Tibet concession, or you don't get Tibet, you know, what do you call it, premium for doing business, actually. It's all the same. So, you know, the Chinese government went all the way, and it became a huge issue when they were investing in Sudan, the southern Sudan and the Sudanese government dispute, and Darfur. If you remember, during Olympics, it became such a big issue. How can Chinese government invest in Sudan when the Darfur genocide in Darfur is going on and southern Sudan is fighting for the independence? But they went and did business there because why? They needed the resources, right? So, Australia has a lot of resources in this resource-starved world. I think Australia has an upper hand. Even the president of Mongolia met his Solomon's Dalai Lama just a few months ago. In fact, Mongolia is, in a way, many ways, completely dependent on China for the for any kind of export, because that's the train route you have to use from Mongolia through China to the seaport and to the outside world. They stopped the railway line for a few days, then it opened because they needed the resources. In fact, Chinese investor went to Mongolia and keep investing, even today.
So, is there anyone I've missed? So just to take you back to where you start, just to brief, got to finish within a couple of minutes. You spoke about the Chinese invasion of 1951, as you know, the revolution in China's 1949. What was the relationship between the nationalist government before 1949 in China and Tibet? And what's the relationship now with Taiwan?
The nationalist government, when they took over in 1911-12, essentially they were so busy trying to consolidate within China. That's how Tibet became, according to some historians, de jure independent, because we entered into treaty with British India in 1914 and other time, and 1913 with Mongolia, but de facto independent. So they were busy. So that's when we established our independent status. That is why in 1951 agreement was signed between Chinese government and Tibetan representatives, which we allege was signed under duress because they had already invaded Tibetan areas. They were moving in, they were telling the representatives, if you don't sign, we are going to invade and move in and forcefully take over. So Tibetans signed that 17-point agreement, which is essentially one country, two system, like Hong Kong. They said Tibet government will recognize that treaty, that agreement still exists. Article 4 and Article Preamble clearly says Tibet shall return to the motherland. Meaning Tibet was independent status, now it is returning to the motherland. So even the Chinese government agreement, that document clearly said it is returning to the motherland. So till 1951, it was an independent nation.
Many thanks. Take a seat over there.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.